From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State John Kerry today strongly defended the U.S.'s decision to abstain from last week's U.N. Security Council vote condemning Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
The vote in the United Nations was about preserving the two-state solution. That's what we were standing up for. Israel's future is a Jewish and democratic state, living side by side in peace and security with its neighbors. That's what we are trying to preserve for our sake and for theirs.
Kerry also outlined a vision for how he believes Mideast peace could be achieved. For more now, let's turn to Greg Myrie. He's international editor for NPR.org and author of the book This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Hi there, Greg.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, as we just heard, Kerry spoke out very strongly against Israeli settlements. He said repeatedly that they're undermining any hope for peace and a two-state solution in the Arab-Israeli conflict. What did you make of the tone of his speech?
Well, the tone, I think, really was the important part of the speech. I mean, you've been hearing phrasing like this and issues like this literally dating back to the 1990s or even earlier. But to see an American Secretary of State stand up and give this long, very impassioned speech at times that was critical at many, many points of Israel, this close ally, that to me was the most absolutely striking picture of the whole speech.
And I mean, when you mentioned that the Secretary of State stood up, I mean, he also stood up in defense of the Obama administration because, of course, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has had a troubled relationship with President Obama. The new president-elect, Donald Trump, has also been highly critical of Obama's policy in the Middle East. But today, the Secretary of State said this.
In fact, this administration has been Israel's greatest friend and supporter with an absolutely unwavering commitment to advancing Israel's security and protecting its legitimacy. On this point, I want to be very clear. No American administration has done more for Israel's security than Barack Obama's.
Greg, that's quite a claim. I mean, would you say that's a fair characterization?
It's a very subjective characterization. Mm-hmm. And I would say there's been this real disconnect between the public friction, which we saw play out today with Secretary Kerry's speech, and the actual substantive things that have taken place. The U.S. has just signed an agreement with Israel recently to provide $38 billion of military assistance over the next 10 years. That's unprecedented. That's a huge amount of military assistance that no other country has ever received. The Iran deal. If you think the Iran deal was a good thing because it got Iran to give up much of its nuclear material, then you would have to say that was something that was very positive for Israel. If you think it was a bad deal because Iran can't be trusted, then you take a very different point of view on that. So this administration did many, many things with Israel's interests in mind, including the many UN resolutions that it vetoed. But Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu saw it very differently. So there was this very strange disconnect between things that the Obama administration has done seemingly or in its view in the interests of Israel, but which Netanyahu and many Israelis have not seen in the same way.
Now, this is very much John Kerry's swan song as Secretary of State. He ends his tenure in a couple of weeks when President-elect Donald Trump becomes the next president of the United States. So, I mean, I guess at this point, Kerry may have nothing left to lose. But on the other hand, one wonders why, if he feels so passionately about this, and he does, he's been trying to broker a peace in the Middle East for years, why not give this speech, I don't know, 2 years ago?
Well, 2 years ago, he was trying to negotiate with the Israelis and Palestinians and was not getting very far. And so I think today really was something he wanted to get off his chest over the past 4 years and perhaps in Obama's case, the past 8 years. So I think it was just an expression of setting down a marker of what they think needs to be done, but also, quite frankly, just getting rid of some frustration of things they haven't been able to do.
Does this speech have any meaning past January 20th?
Not really. It's going to be very different, I think, when Donald Trump comes into office. You have had this bilateral consensus among Republican and Democratic presidents for decades about how to approach the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the notion of a two-state solution. Trump has certainly hinted strongly that that's not going to be his top consideration or his top policy. And again, we've seen with his choice of ambassador as well. So we might be headed in a very different direction, and everything John Kerry said today may not matter after January 20th.
Well, Greg Myrie is international editor for NPR.org. Greg, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Across the country, the search is on for new sources of clean energy, and one place to find it could be the Ohio River. The Ohio and its tributaries could become a hotspot for new hydropower development using the region's extensive network of navigation dams rather than building new artificial lakes. But not everyone wants to take the hydro plunge. Reed Frazier from Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front reports from Pittsburgh.
Paul Jacob watches water spill over the Emsworth Dam on the Ohio River near Pittsburgh. The water forms a white froth at the base of the dam before flowing into the brown waters. To Jacob, that froth looks like opportunity.
If you look out, you'll see all the water that's flowing over that dam. That basically is unused energy.
Jacob is with Rye Development, a company that has proposed building a small hydropower plant here at Emsworth and at 9 other dams in western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. If approved, the projects could come online by 2019. The amount of energy these hydropower plants would create isn't enormous. The Emsworth Dam could power only 6,000 to 12,000 homes. But even at this scale, says Jacob, these projects can benefit the economy and the environment.
It's a carbon-free resource. So once this is built, it'll just operate. The life of these projects is extremely long compared to most other resources. So it makes a good contribution in terms of adding a renewable resource that's also available on a 24/7 basis.
I think that often it's talked about as the silent renewable.
David Zayas is with the National Hydropower Association. He says hydropower has been around so long, some people assume there's no room for it to grow. But hydropower is still the biggest source of renewable energy in the country, accounting for 7% of all electricity in the U.S. And the Department of Energy says the industry could grow by 50% over the next 3 decades.
You know, the myth of that hydropower is all tapped out, and that Pennsylvania is a really good example of that not being the case.
With its plentiful rainfall and dammed up rivers, the Keystone State is well suited for hydro, says Lindsay Baxter of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She says hydro also fits well with what a modernized grid will look like.
The future of power generation is going to be more distributed, smaller resources that are very low or no carbon emitting. And hydro feeds into that and could be very complementary to some of the other resources like wind and solar.
Baxter's group is pushing for more hydropower, but it doesn't want big new dams that can wipe out habitat or displace homes and businesses. Instead, Baxter thinks building projects onto existing dams makes the most sense.
That's really where we see more of the opportunity, where you have a previously disturbed environment. Sometimes those can be retrofitted to produce power with very little or no impacts on the environment.
Actually, some worry new hydropower plants, even on existing dams, could be bad for rivers. On a recent afternoon, Rob Walters took me on a cruise up the Allegheny River, a few miles from where it flows into the Ohio.
And there is one guy fishing.
Over there. Walters is with Three Rivers Waterkeeper. The group monitors water quality on Pittsburgh's rivers, which have slowly seen fish populations increase after decades of industrial pollution. We idle just below the Highland Park Dam, the site of another one of Rye Development's proposed hydroelectric projects. He says this is the best spot on the river to fish.
You know, so why are the fish there and not just, like, I don't know, in the middle of the river?
The dissolved oxygen. There's more oxygen concentrated at the dam. It's turbulent, so...
On a dammed up river like this one, water spilling over the dam is one of the few ways oxygen gets infused into the water, feeding plants and fish. Biologists worry a hydropower plant would funnel some of this turbulent water through turbines, dropping dissolved oxygen in the river to dangerous levels. Building the plant would also mean dredging, which could stir up industrial leftovers from Pittsburgh's past.
And we're talking a lot of metals and some seriously nasty pollutants that are buried and packed down, down, and down. When you dredge, you bring all of that up, not only up, but into the water column.
Water quality isn't the only thing Walters worries about. He points to a spit of rocks just below the dam. A man sits on a chair. Next to him, a cooler, a bait bucket, and a fishing rod.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. And why should we take that away from him? And
Walter says he's in favor of clean energy, but he doesn't want it to come at the cost of the region's rivers and those who use them. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
2016 marked 100 years of the National Park Service, and in August, Here and Now's Jeremy Hobson visited Yellowstone National Park, where he met Jennifer Jarrett. Her job is to record the sounds of Yellowstone as part of a partnership between the park and the Acoustic Atlas, a nature and soundscape archive at Montana State University's library. Jennifer spoke with Jeremy outside and brought her laptop along to play the sounds she's recorded. And Jeremy asked her why it's so important to document what Yellowstone sounds like.
The short story, I guess, is that these sounds could go away. You know, we're losing species at an unprecedented rate in human history, and I don't need to tell you that there's probably more to come. So from that perspective, it's important to document what's out there and get a record of these players in our soundscapes.
And in order to get the sounds, do you have to get into some dangerous situations? Because some of these animals you probably wouldn't want to hang out with one-on-one.
I am very cognizant of not getting myself into dangerous situations. That's a really big component of my planning phase of gathering recordings. And I have a couple of tricks to keep myself safe. And one of them, you know, oftentimes I'll do some recording just from the safety of my vehicle and put the microphone out, run a cable into the car and sit in the car and record. I also use remote recording devices, especially for situations where it wouldn't make sense for me to be present. And otherwise, I keep my distance. You know, I stay 100 yards away from wolves and bears, 25 yards away from everything else. And the mics I use are pretty powerful, so they have a long reach. And I'm able to get great recordings in spite of the distance.
Well, let's hear some of the sounds that you have collected while you've been here, starting with what?
You know, I was actually going to start with a simple recording of a meadowlark. And the thing that I like about this recording is that the meadowlark, the western meadowlark, really spends a lot of its time in the sagebrush steppe. And in Yellowstone National Park, we have a lot of sagebrush communities. And it's kind of easy, an easy little ecosystem to overlook. But in the whole world, we have this in North America only. So it's a special system, and over 350 species rely on the sagebrush steppe.
So tell us what we're hearing there.
So what you heard is runoff from the Mammoth Hot Springs thermal system has a runoff channel that runs down the hill and kind of behind the residence area. And so this was just me getting up early one spring morning and heading down with my gear, setting it up right at that runoff channel. And there was a meadowlark who flew in and just perched very close to me and the microphone and just sang his heart out.
Okay, what is next on your list?
So this is, every fall, we have the elk rut, the mating season for elk. And in Mammoth, there's kind of a resident elk herd. And what happens is that there'll be a couple main bulls who are competing for dominance, for the privilege of breeding with the cows that are up there. And then oftentimes there'll be some satellite bulls around in the area hoping to also kind of step up and compete. And this was late at night, and literally right across the street from the house, these two bull elk got into it and just started fighting, clacking antlers, the whole deal. It was crazy.
And how close was your microphone?
I was about, I'd say I was 30 yards away from these guys, so pretty close. But this is the scene in Upper Mammoth, like every night, all night long. And I call it elksomnia because you don't get any sleep because the elk are just going crazy all night long.
Hey,
Now, how does this fight end?
You know, it seems like one animal kind of gets tired and just defers to the other one. It's wild. It's not like it ends in death or something really dramatic. It's just they'll fight for a while, and then it's like there's some kind of unspoken agreement between these two guys, and it's like, okay, man, you win.
Okay, we've had our beautiful songbird and now our fight. What's next?
Okay, next up, let's listen to sort of a quintessential sound of Yellowstone.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so those wolves, those were the Lamar Canyon pack. I recorded that this past January from the road. So when we were talking about recording from the safety of the car, that was one of those instances. And not that wolves are dangerous, but it's more I just don't want to impact the behavior of the animals. I'm trying not to have them be hyper aware of my presence. But it was very cool. They were pretty close and kind of circling the parking area and then moving off into the sage. And what was really interesting about that recording is right in the beginning, did you hear it sounded like a dog whining? Okay, so that was something that even the researchers hadn't really heard before. Oftentimes when you're out watching wolves or if I'm trying to record wolves, they're very, very far away. So you don't have the opportunity to get that kind of detail. So that was a very cool thing.
Now, it's not just animals that you record, but also some of the geology here, some of the geysers and things like that.
Exactly. Absolutely. I spend a fair bit of my time recording the thermal features in the park. And it's important to kind of point out about this is that as water moving through the landscape changes, whether that's seasonally or as a result of longer-term impacts from things like climate change, you know, so too will the sounds of these thermal features change. So again, an important thing to document. One of my favorite things to record are the mud pots. And so this next recording is fountain paint pots.
And we should say there's not like a hippopotamus in there or something like that.
No, that is just all of the thermal activity, the release of heat and gases through that mud that microbes and other chemical reactions have kind of broken down rock to create this mud. And then that's just all that activity bubbling up through the mud.
And do you have to be careful about exactly when you record that to get it to sound like that? Or is it kind of like that all the time?
Well, I mean, it'll kind of do glurpity-glurpity all year round. But definitely in the springtime, when more water is moving through the system, it sounds like that. That was recorded in, I think, early May. And then later in the year, it's not as much, but you can still get some nice recordings.
So much activity going on in there.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? I could totally just sit and listen to mud pots for, like, 20 minutes. Every time I go record there, it's just, you know, it's easily an hour just monitoring through my headphones because it's like a little meditation just to kind of get into it.
Now, Jennifer, we could not possibly talk to you about the sounds of the park without asking if you've got any sounds of grizzly bears.
I do have sounds of grizzly bears. I have like the recording of grizzly bears. Okay, so early in the program, we talked about, again, the use of remote recorders. This is absolutely a recording that was made with a remote recorder. There was a road-killed bison that park scientists had moved off the road so it didn't pose a safety hazard. And then I went with the bear biologist and we set up a remote field recorder in the hopes of getting the sounds of grizzly bears. And this is what we got.
Oh, we're sitting outside right now. I hope that that doesn't call them over here or anything like that right now, does it?
I don't think so. So, I mean, isn't that crazy?
How did you get that?
I set up a remote recorder. I just had it set to record continuously.
But how close is it to the carcass?
From me to you. I mean, those bears, I have sections, I have hours of this. I have sections of recording where you can hear the fur of the bear, you know, rubbing up against the recorder. It's amazing. But so what's even better is that we actually know a little bit about these bears because we also set up a remote camera. And I don't know if these bears were collared or how they were identified, but the grizzly scientists told me that it's a male and a female. They were both about 7 years old. It was recorded in late June, which, you know, does coincide with bear mating season. I don't know if these bears were pairing up or if they just happened to be in the same location feeding on the same carcass, but it was those two bears interacting with each other.
Wow.
So cool.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing these sounds with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
They're incredible. Definitely so cool. That's Jennifer Jarrett, an audio archivist for Yellowstone National Park. She spoke with Here and Now's Jeremy Hobson in August. Holiday shopping season is officially over, which means we're in holiday returns season. But so far, it's been a strong period for retailers, with November sales up 5% from last year, according to the National Retail Federation. And consumer confidence overall has hit its highest point since 2001. So joining us now with more, Sonari Glinton, NPR business correspondent. Hi there, Sonari.
Hey, Magda. Happy holidays.
Hey, happy holidays to you, too. So tell us, what do we know so far about the holiday season? Did retailers do as well as they'd hoped?
Well, here's the thing. What's good for consumers is not always good for retailers, right? So if you think a strong dollar, low unemployment, falling prices for consumer goods, record levels on markets like the NASDAQ, relatively low gas prices, you know, home values are up. I could keep going on and on. Those are all good things. But when you look at what's happening with retailers, consumers have gotten smarter. And when a billion items were shipped on Amazon over the holidays, that's a record for them. People are using their smartphones not only to buy, which, you know, that's where all the growth in retail is essentially, but they're also using it to comparison shop. So they're demanding more deals. And so that means that while all these other numbers are great, retailers are like, meh, because of a myriad of reasons and mainly a smarter consumer.
I see. Okay. So we saw that over the holidays then. Is that on par with how retail has been doing overall this year?
Yeah, and yes, exactly. And what you need to understand is during the last economic collapse, right, we talk about the housing boom, right? But what people don't remember, it was a construction boom. Mm-hmm. And we built way more retail, way, way, way more retail than we could use or that any sort of industrialized nation needs. We have three times as much retail space per person than any of the other industrialized nations. So you have, while you have this disruption coming with Amazon, you also have this, you know, retailers who are just doing, who aren't doing as well. They have to maintain all of this real estate, all of these distribution centers. And 8 out of 10 of retailers are online, but are they, I mean, when was the last time someone bought an online item that wasn't from Amazon? I mean, think about how far down the list you have to go before, you know, you're picking it up at, you know, your local, you know, your local A&P or things like that.
Right. Yep. So, as you mentioned earlier, though, like what's great for consumers may not be so good for retailers. I mean, that brings us back to the fact that consumer confidence this month hit its highest level since 2001. So tell us more about that.
Well, consumer confidence has been on a trend upwards. We had a bump in November, in part because of the election. And remember, you know, the stock market is going gangbusters. It's reaching levels. That has to do with what's going on sort of at the top. You know, the average American does not have stocks and isn't more wealthier. But it's that feeling that things are good and things are going this way. So, you know, when we look at the economy as we're going forward and that consumer confidence number, the strongest number was the one that was not necessarily economic conditions right now, but the economic conditions 6 months. And when you look at tax cuts and lower regulations and an excited business class, then that translates into higher consumer confidence.
I see. So hope does spring eternal. Well, NPR business correspondent Sonari Glinton, thank you so much and very happy new year to you.
Happy new year to you and everyone who's listening.
We've remembered the lives of two women who played a big role in our love of space and space exploration. In the world of film fiction, Carrie Fisher, of course, who played the iconic Princess Leia in Star Wars. And in real life, Vera Rubin, pioneer astronomer and physicist who confirmed the existence of dark matter. And of course, they both passed away this year, but there were also plenty of events to celebrate this year when it comes to space. And here to help us look back on the year in space news is David Newman, Deputy Administrator of NASA. Deputy Administrator, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be with you, Magna. Hello.
Well, hello. It's been a big year for space and space exploration. What's your number one highlight for the year?
Well, I have about three dozen, so I can only have time to tell you about a few. But, you know, we got to Jupiter again in orbit with our Juno mission, the goddess of Jupiter, to take the most precise data we've ever taken. And we're still there, you know, for 20 months in orbit. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's a rendezvous 5 years in the making, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, all of our missions, a lot of times it takes us, you know, an entire decade to get there. This one's 5 years. Remember when we got to Pluto before? That was just a 9-year journey.
Just a 9-year journey.
So, and people work on it for, like, you know, 30 years of their career. So that's the thing. It's not for the faint of heart. You know, a lot of our major, you know, science missions, it's just the dedication, the passion. So they're all kind of highlights.
So what is it that the Juno mission hopes to discover or uncover about Jupiter?
So we've had previous missions to Jupiter, but this one is in a really interesting polar orbit. The Jupiter environment is incredibly extreme. So it's about 20 million times more. The radiation environment is about 20 million times stronger than what we experience. And so we're really trying to understand the Jupiter and in Jupiter orbit, the environment. Really, all of our exploring goes back to those enduring questions. Are there other habitable planets? Are we alone in the universe? And then what about past life,
right?
Especially in our solar system?
So about those other planets, we have to talk about the Kepler mission, right? I mean, it seems like there were a lot of discoveries there.
Oh, my goodness. We have over 3,000 candidate exoplanets and a couple dozen that we say are in that habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone, I like to call it. Not too hot, not too cold, really the ideal, you know, Earth-like exoplanets, especially when it comes to the chemical compositions. When we look for life in the universe, we say follow the water, in terms that these planets might have that would give us the first evidence or clues that there could be life there.
Yeah. Let's stay in this solar system for another moment, because the European Space Agency had an unmanned mission that arrived at Mars. I mean, your cousin's there at the ESA, so not a NASA mission. That's pretty exciting, too. We're continuing to develop our understanding of our nearest neighbor.
We sure are. And we were on board. We work with the Europeans and the Russians in that case. You know, they led the ExoMars, but really amazing. We, meaning the world, because we think exploration and specifically the journey to Mars that NASA's leading, we see this as global exploration. And did you know that we have 7 assets, let's call them? NASA has 2 rovers, and we have 3 orbiters around Mars today, orbiting Mars. MAVEN is maybe our most famous, and it's given us incredible scientific data. We now, the first papers are published on how Mars lost its atmosphere, leaving us today with 1% carbon dioxide atmosphere. And the Indian Space Agency, MOM, I love their acronym, that's the Mars Observer Mission. MOM is also in orbit, and as you just mentioned, then most recently, the ExoMars from ESA and Russia, their orbiter, is working. So we're on it. We are definitely studying Mars every single day.
So 7 assets, as you say, but no humans yet. I mean, how much closer are we to getting a manned mission on the way to Mars?
Well, it'll be a human mission. I'm thinking with probably a female commander. And we are closer today. Humanity is closer today than we've ever been in history. So that's, as you know me, I work on that 24/7.
Yeah.
So every day, every night, that's what I kind of live and breathe and think about is getting that horizon goal of our journey to Mars, getting humans to the red planet. We're still on track. It's affordable, sustainable to get there in the 2030s. So we have to keep making all the great progress that we're making.
Yeah. So when you say we're on track for a Mars mission in the 2030s, that would be a launch date in the 2030s?
Yes, a launch date, and it's round trip.
Mm-hmm. So teenagers listening to this right now, it could be you.
when it when is, we're, it absolutely is them. I call anyone in school today, they are the Mars generation. I literally call them the Mars generation. So boots on Mars, it's going to be a young person hopefully listening to this interview.
Absolutely. So you mentioned where human beings are in space right now. And so we have to mention Commander Scott Kelly's 520 days in space. The man who had the best Instagram and Twitter feed, by the way, with all those glorious pictures that he had every day. A true accomplishment, but I understand that that's actually not the record for an American's time in space.
Yeah, can you believe it? So again, 2016, record after record. So when it comes to Scott's one-year mission, just couldn't have gone better. Did over 400, you know, science experiments, as you say, his Twitter feed and the social media. And guess what? Jeff Williams just broke Scott's record, being the American spending the most days in space. Now, not consecutive. Scott's close to 1 year mission was the longest mission at once. But see, Jeff Williams, he just finished his third increment up on International Space Station. And move over Scott and Jeff, because guess what? Peggy Whitson's up there, and she's going to break their records in 2017.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. You know, at this point in time, some of our listeners are listening with justifiably, scrutinizing ears and critical ears, and they're probably thinking, you know what, this has been a little too rah-rah, because there have been some setbacks. For example, in 2016, NASA is doing a lot of partnerships with private companies in order to get a lot of these missions off the ground. There's been a couple explosions with SpaceX rockets, for example, and an inability to fully prove that a reusable rocket is a reality. I mean, talk to me about those setbacks that you also saw in 2016.
Absolutely. First and foremost, spaceflight is hard. There are accidents. SpaceX had an accident this year, and the previous year there were a couple accidents. But you know what? That's what the government does. That's what NASA does. We're investing in the private sector. We want to see them all succeed. And so we are betting on their success. They're excellent. They're going to succeed. And we're investing right now for our International Space Station for cargo capability in SpaceX, Orbital ATK. And in the next phase of contracts, a third company, Sierra Nevada Corporation, is on track to, again, join both SpaceX and Orbital in terms of bringing cargo to space station.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Newman, we can't end this conversation without talking about a great loss that the American space program and the country as a whole experienced just this month when John Glenn passed away at the age of 95. I was just before our conversation looking back at the film footage of his 1962 orbit around planet Earth aboard Friendship 7. It brought chills yet again just watching him. And I was listening to the transmission between him and Mission Control. And there's that moment where he first turns around. And he says, the capsule is turned, and he sees the view. And he says, oh, what a tremendous view. I mean, like, I'm telling you, it does give me chills just thinking about it once again. But I just wonder what the feeling was there at NASA when the news came that John Glenn had passed away.
Well, he was an American hero and probably why I'm, aerospace engineer today and even deputy minister. Just he touched all of us. And it was so we celebrated his life and memorial with his family last Saturday in Columbus. And it gave us actually really important. It was timing. At 95 years old, what people I think don't quite realize is that sure, he was the American first one in orbit, right? The test pilot. How many missions he did, both in Vietnam and Korea. But guess what? That was just the start of his career. Then he became an unbelievable statesman. He became a U.S. senator. He ran for president. I mean, on and on. And at 77, his second mission.
That's right.
We were actually really fortunate from my former lab at MIT. We got to fly an experiment, and put an EEG brain cap on him. And guess what we learned?
What?
At 77, the oldest man ever to be in orbit. Physically and mentally, he's like a 55-year-old. So he inspires all of us, and his life and legacy, and again, just what an American hero he was.
Well, Dr. David Newman is Deputy Administrator of NASA, helping us go through some highlights in space exploration in 2016. Dr. Newman, thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you. Summer Sunday nights, we sink into our seats right as they dimmed out all the lights. A technicolor world made out of music and machine. It called me to be on that screen.
That's Another Day of Sun from the new musical La La Land. The movie stars Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling as an aspiring actress and a jazz musician who are trying to make it in Hollywood. La La Land has been getting a lot of love for bringing new life to the movie musical genre, and it's set in a place that movie makers have turned to before for inspiration. So that made us want to look at other films that have been made in or about Hollywood. And here to help us do that is Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Ty, it's great to see you as always.
Hello, Magda.
Well, first of all, why is Hollywood so appealing for filmmakers? I mean, is it just that it's there and they know it well?
Yes, there is an aspect of navel-gazing on the part of, you know, this is what filmmakers do, so why not film what you know? But there's also, I mean, America in the 20th century and the 21st century is built upon the Dream Factory, and we're fascinated with what goes on the other side of the Dream Factory, the lives that they live, how these dreams get put together. So we're fascinated by those stories and always have been from Star is Born on.
Yeah, how they get put together and sometimes how those dreams get crushed, too.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's talk about some of the films on your list. We have the entire list, by the way, at our website, hereandnow.org. But Ty, let's start with possibly the classic here, because the song and dance numbers of La La Land recall some beautiful old-style musicals like, of course, here it comes, 1952's Singin' in the Rain, with classics like this number.
Good morning, good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning to you.
So, Ty, what does Singin' in the Rain tell us about Hollywood?
And what you actually can't see, listeners, is that Magda and I are now dancing around this.
And I'm doing it in heels backwards.
Yeah. What does this tell us about the Dream Factory is that it's resilient, that it would always bounce back in the face of crisis, in this case, the coming of the talkie revolution, and also that wonderful world of the musicals where you can just burst into song and dance and it's in you and it will come out and it will look great. And that's what La La Land's all about, even if, as much as I love the movie, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling are not dancers and singers of the caliber that you will find in Singin' in the Rain.
Yeah. So let's turn to a very different film. This one also talks about Hollywood of the 1950s, though. This is In a Lonely Place, starring Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham. Tell us about this film.
Well, the reason I included it in this list is that it kind of plays like La La Land, not as a musical, but a film noir.
Hmm.
It's also, in my opinion, the best performance Humphrey Bogart ever gave. He plays a kind of paranoid, not too easy to get along with screenwriter who falls in love with a woman in his housing complex. They live in L.A. They're in the business. And she's played by Gloria Graham. We're about to listen to a scene where the romance is going well, and you can get that sort of double-edged sense of they're talking about their lives, but they're also talking about fictionalizing their lives.
I love the love scene. It's very good.
Well, that's because they're not always telling each other how much in love they are. A good love scene should be about something else beside love. For instance, this one. Me fixing grapefruit, you sitting over there dopey, half asleep. Anyone looking at us could tell we were in love.
And it goes south from there.
Wow. Well, let's move forward then out of the 50s and into the early 2000s, because you wanted to talk about David Lynch's 2001 movie Mulholland Drive. Why
yeah.
is that?
We're talking about the Dream Factory. This
yeah.
is a nightmare about the Dream yeah. Factory. I love this movie because it messes with your mind, but also because it comments in a very subconscious way on our need to become celebrities, our need to make fictions of our lives, the whole love affair and hate affair we have with Hollywood.
Absolutely. Well, let's bounce around a little bit because you also wanted to touch on 1997's L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, I love that movie just because it's about the dirt behind the cleanness of Hollywood. And there are true stories in this, including the one about the brothel where the prostitutes have facial work to look like actual Hollywood stars. That's a real thing. So again, peek behind the pretty facade, and what do you got? You've got drama. You've got interesting lives.
Hmm. Well, Ty, again, I just want to remind folks that we've got your whole list at hereandnow.org. And you wanted to talk about one movie that you say has a direct influence on La La Land, but it's not even set in Hollywood?
No. And it is Francis Ford Coppola's 1981 One from the Heart, which is set in Las Vegas, but it's a gaudy neon paradise only in the movies Las Vegas. But the reason I'm citing it is because, like La La Land, it's about two average people trying to live in this dreamlike paradise and have a romantic relationship that works. They don't sing and dance. That's about the only thing that's missing that connects with La La Land. But on the soundtrack of One from the Heart is one of the great soundtrack duets of all time, Tom Waits and Crystal Gayle. It's one of the best things you'll ever hear.
It's got to be love. I've never felt this way.
We've been talking to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about films from Hollywood, about Hollywood, given the release of La La Land. Ty, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so very much, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Magna. Happy New Year to you, too.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.